This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, Associate Director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative at Harvard, and this is Leader ReadyCast. So what exactly is leadership? I mean, scholars have no commonly accepted definition, and there are plenty of people in leadership positions who don't seem to be doing a whole lot of leading, at least as I think of it. And perhaps thinking about leading differently would help us to get to a better, more positive answer. My guest today, Jonathan Clark, is co-author of a fascinating new book, Leading Through: Activating the Soul, Heart, and Mind of Leadership. It tackles this daunting task. I was interested in having this conversation with Jonathan for a number of reasons. He and his co-authors define leadership as seeking to, quote, do good and make things better for the long term. And that's a definition I like a lot. And I know that many of you who are listening do exactly that work. Their model also harmonizes with the meta-leadership framework that we use at the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, as it puts the leader in the middle of the situation, not necessarily perched atop a lofty hierarchy. And they too see the need to unlock the leadership potential in everyone in the organization, leading from where you are. Now, Jonathan Clark is a professor of management at the University of Texas at San Antonio. His co-authors are his father, Kim Clark, and his sister, Erin Clark. Now, Kim Clark was dean of the Harvard Business School when I worked there at Harvard Business Publishing many years ago. And Jonathan's a graduate of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, where I now have my appointments. We have lots of things in common. Together, these three bring together academic rigor and pragmatic experience. So this is a really it's a hands-on book, and it's something else we value here at the MPLI. So I'm hoping this is going to be a really interesting and robust conversation. Jonathan, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thank you, Eric. Glad to be here.
In the book, you describe the leading through approach as a paradigm shift. So give our listeners an overview of what that is and how it works.
Well, I think maybe the best way to do that would be to share a little story. Years ago, probably more than 40 years ago, when my dad was early in his academic career, He was studying operational performance in the cement industry. And he got all this data and he looked at the data and he was just amazed at how much variation there was in performance, in the productivity of cement plants all across the world. And he noticed in his data that there were two cement plants that were nearly identical in every way, including the town in which they were located. They were both located in Midlothian, Texas. They were similar in just about every way, except that one of those plants was 2 to 3 times more productive than the other one. And so he went with some colleagues to visit those plants to try to understand what's going on here. And what they found was something I think it's remarkable. He thought it was remarkable at the time. And actually what he found there kind of serves as, in many ways, the basis for what this book has become. What he found was that in one of those plants, the lower performing plant, things were very hierarchical, very centralized. People were very unhappy. People were narrowly focused on very, very circumscribed jobs that used almost none of their talents. And people were just sort of focused on following rules and procedures and, you know, getting whatever it is that they were asked to do done and going home at the end of the day. And that hierarchy in which they worked was, I think they found there were 7 or 8 layers in that hierarchy between the plant manager and frontline workers. And what they found was very different in the other plant. In the other plant, it was a very short, flat hierarchy, only 3 layers between the plant manager and frontline workers. And people were happy. People were very happy. They were committed to their employer. They were engaged, and they were doing things to benefit their employer. And in fact, one of the key things that my dad and his colleagues observed there was, I think, something very similar to what you and your colleagues, Eric, describe as swarm leadership.
Yeah.
It was basically people all throughout the organization taking initiative to make things better, to make the processes more productive, to make their colleagues happier and more committed at work. And they were all doing it in a way that was unified. So people had some level of autonomy, freedom of action to take that initiative. But at the same time, the way they used it resulted in a unified effort. And the result was, I mean, you know, they were just far more productive than the other plant. And it turns out that kind of way of working and organizing is pretty unique. It's pretty rare. What he saw in the other plant, the lower performing plant, is much more common. It's much more dominant. We call it the power over paradigm. It's a paradigm of work and organization that's focused on driving execution through control and compliance, rather than seeking for innovation, seeking for continuous improvement through commitment and through initiative. Now, fast forward from my dad's experience to my own research, you know, more than 20 years later, I start studying hospitals and physician groups and essentially find exactly the same thing, right? You find in some physician groups, you see people taking initiative, bending over backwards. I once interviewed a nurse who described this incredible experience she had basically helping a patient overcome every barrier they faced, including financial barriers, transportation barriers, other social barriers, to make sure that patient could get what they needed when they needed it by the provider they needed it from. And you just don't see that very often. You don't see that kind of heroic effort, that heroic initiative very often. So I started seeing the same thing in healthcare. And simultaneously, my sister, who's a partner at Deloitte Consulting, she runs the leadership practice in the Human Capital Group. You know, she's observing very similar things among her clients. And so, you know, eventually we kind of coalesce together. We're all working on these things independently. We eventually coalesce together and decide, you know, we need to write a book about this. And so that's what we did. And the book is really aimed ultimately at helping people to see the central role of leadership in helping people and organizations to thrive. It's also, I think, about helping people to see that the dominant ways of working, the dominant paradigm, is largely void of real leadership, at least as we see it. And so so that paradigm shift really is about moving from that power over paradigm to what we call the leading through paradigm.
So why do you think that old model is so persistent? Because we've been talking about this, as you know, for decades, about moving beyond that sort of control and compliance mindset. And you've laid out a convincing case here, and there is lots of research to show that it is, you get more productivity, you get better results, you get all kinds of good things when you lead more in the model you're talking about and leading through. So why do you think we can't let go of that old model?
That's a great question. And especially, as you pointed out, in the context of the fact that we've been warning people about that control through compliance approach for a long time. I mean, at least as far back as Mary Parker Follett, who was warning about control through compliance all the way back in the 1920s. So we do discuss several reasons for this, several possible reasons for this in the book, but let me mention just a couple. The first is that power seems to interact with human tendencies in ways that reinforce that paradigm. As people gain power, and there's lots of research to show this, as people gain power, they tend to use it to exercise control and dominion over other people. In other words, once they have power, they tend to try to reinforce that they have power, and they take steps to retain it, and use it to assert their influence over others. And that seems to happen almost naturally in the absence of strong counteractive structures or cultural elements that push people away from that. And so people tend to use power almost naturally in that way. So that's one reason. Another related reason is that this power over approach somehow has just become so deeply embedded in everything we do. You know, in vast majority of organizations, and this has been true for more than a century, probably even much longer than that. But somehow this approach has become so deeply embedded in how people think organizations should work. In fact, we're taught and trained from a very early age to operate within this paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. You think about what do kids in kindergarten learn? You know, we're not teaching kids in kindergarten how to take initiative and be creative and innovative. We're teaching kids in kindergarten how to comply with authority.
Right.
And in fact, that's an idea that I first came across. I think it was Seth Godin that I heard say that look, if you look at what's happening to our kids very early in life, we're training them in this power over paradigm. And that continues all the way throughout their life. When they start working at a fast food restaurant and when they're a teenager, or when they go to college, you know, I mean, unfortunately, most universities are also bathed in this power over paradigm. And so it's just deeply ingrained in everything we do.
So then, yeah, absolutely. And I think we also do a very good job of rewarding dominant individuals, and they rise in organizations. But let's move out of the darkness and into the light, because that's where your book wants to take us. And I think it's where we want to be. So you say that leadership is work, leadership mobilizes people, and leadership is process. Why do you call out these three components for your definition of leadership?
Well, you know, we focus on work. We use that word in part because we don't think there's a better word to describe what we observe when we observe leaders. And using that word helps us get unstuck from old ways of thinking about leadership. You know, mm-hmm. Leadership is not a personality trait. Leadership is not a position, even though we often use the word to refer to position, right? You know, and
yeah.
You go to many organizations and they refer to the leadership, right? What they mean is the executive team.
That makes me crazy when people do that.
Yeah. But it's very common, right? And so I think by focusing on leadership as work, it helps get us unstuck from those ways of thinking about leadership. That work, the work of leadership, is also always about people. At least leadership as we define it is always about people, and it's about mobilizing people. We use that word mobilize, I think in part because as a concept, mobilization, I think, allows us to retain some level of agency in the follower. And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes for us leadership from other concepts like coercion or manipulation, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever other way that people might use to influence people. It is that when people, you know, when we observe leadership, we see people choosing to take action and learn and change in ways that make things better, rather than being coerced or manipulated into doing those things. And so we focus on that word mobilizing, right? Because the leaders, at the end of the day, what they're doing is creating the conditions under which people can choose to use their energy and their effort and their talents to make things better. And so we really do focus on people. And for us, leadership it's really important for leaders to understand the connection between the well-being and progress of people and the well-being and progress of organizations. And finally, we think of leadership as a process to help people recognize that anybody can do it. You know, leadership for us is a set of activities and skills that are observable, they're definable, We think they're repeatable and teachable. And what we observe leaders doing across settings and across levels and across circumstances, whether we're talking about, you know, a few people in a team or even two people in a relationship or an executive trying to drive change in their organization, the patterns look very similar to us. And we think those are definable and repeatable and teachable. And we want people to understand that. We want people to understand that anybody can do it. And actually, I think most of us should be engaging in more leadership.
So I love that. I love the way you put that together, because it is work. It's hard work. And I think people need to realize that all the benefits at the other end are well worth it. And that is, it is so much about people and investing in people and investing in those relationships. So as you say, you can create those conditions under which they can give you their best, which is ultimately at the end of the day, what you want. So I think one of the interesting elements of your model is it puts forth leadership as a moral undertaking. In fact, one of my former students just wrote this week saying, you know, how do we think about leadership in the context of people who are doing bad things in the world? And so you talk about the soul of leadership, and say you've talked about, you define leadership as trying to make the world a better place. So how does that play out in practice? Because I can really see that as a place where some executives would be a bit uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. In fact, I would say there are two words that we use often in the book that kind of elicit a visceral reaction from executives. The first is moral.
Yep.
The second is love. And these are, I think, you know, once we talk to them, we sort of explain what we're talking about, then they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But the initial reactions are definitely confused. Let me start by saying why we believe leadership is always and everywhere a moral work. For us, potential leaders and the potential for leadership emerges from moments of influence, right?
Yep.
Somebody somewhere finds themselves in a situation, a moment where they have an opportunity to influence other people and to potentially make a difference, and they can use that influence for good or for bad, and for us, that is the thing that makes leadership always and everywhere a moral work. And from our perspective, we sort of put a stake in the ground, and we want leadership to be a concept that is centered around doing good. And we believe that effective leaders always seek to do good and always seek to make things better for other people. And we call that element of the work of leadership the soul of leadership. And that the soul of leadership demands that leaders and those they lead strive to do the right thing because it's the right thing, even when it's really hard, even when there are obstacles to doing the right thing. And because of that, because there's this responsibility embedded in the work of leadership, I think the people doing that work and, you know, everyone following that work needs a moral context. They need a moral context that supports and enables doing good. In practice, I think that looks like, you know, having a set of values and beliefs, but it's much more than just stating values and beliefs. It's much more than having words on a website or on a wall. It's about doing real work, the hard work to help people discern what those values and beliefs mean for their work, for the things that they do every day, and also helping people to have the discipline to live up to those values and live according to those beliefs in everything that they do.
It's such a refreshing way of looking at it, because I see too often that the bar is set is it legal? And then perhaps, okay, if we've got some ethical guidelines or our profession does, do we meet those? But never making that extra step to moral. And I think that makes the work both more enduring and more satisfying. And as you say, much, much better for the long haul. And so I'm glad that people are getting over their fear of the word once you explain it.
Yeah, there really is sometimes like, and some of this is because, you know, we've, Some of it may be the divisiveness of our current society. when you use the term moral, maybe that's associated with one side or the other of a
Yeah.
particular view about what is good and what is right or what is wrong.
Yeah.
People
No,
tend to have an initial negative reaction.
I was speaking to someone recently in the pharmaceuticals industry, and they were talking about the fear they had that if they lowered the cost of a drug so it could be accessible to more people, they actually opened themselves up to lawsuits from shareholders who said, "No, your job is to make as much money as possible, not to get
Right.
the and but so that tension is there in our system, right? That is a thing, and it's a real challenge.
Yeah. By the way, I think those shareholders are wrong.
I do too. I absolutely do too.
Even if they took it to the courts, I don't think the courts would uphold their position.
Yeah, absolutely. So related to this, you talk about leaders bringing light into an organization. What does that mean, and what does that look like in practice?
Oh, that's a really good question. This is a really central aspect of our perspective. This is a metaphor, the metaphor of light and darkness that we kind of borrow from Martin Luther King. He said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that." And from our perspective, the soul of leadership, that work I was just describing, the work of doing good, that work has to overcome what we call organizational darkness. This is attitudes and behaviors and practices that make seeing the right way forward and doing it more difficult. So this is, you can imagine there's like an unlimited number of things that can cause this kind of have this effect, right?
Yes.
Arrogance, bullying, exploitation, harassment, discrimination, so on and so forth, right?
Oh, I see. You and I have worked in the same places. Or at
Yeah.
least visited the same places. That's a,
Both,
but
both. Yeah.
yeah, it's unfortunately too common in the workplace, all of those things.
Yep. And those things create darkness, right? It just makes people, it saps meaning from the work. It causes people to disengage, and it really serves, it constrains the ability of the organization to make progress and to move forward. And so you've got to overcome that as a leader. And in contrast, light guides and energizes people. And it's sustained by things like kindness and generosity, respect for others, love. I used that word before, love. In fact, I would say it starts with love. Helping to give people personal meaning and growth, having a shared purpose. These are all things that uplift and strengthen people. And just like physical light, organizational light is a source of both vision and energy in organizations. And that light, light's not, as a metaphor, it's not hard to understand, right? I mean, it creates the conditions for growth and increased strength in individual people and their lives, reputations, in the assets of the organization and in the organization itself. And so, when our values and beliefs are centered on good things, on putting those values and beliefs into practice, it creates what we call organizational light. And for us, it's a game changer.
Do you have an organization you would cite that you think has a lot of light emanating within and without?
I would say, I haven't studied them more recently, but I would say during the years that Toby Cosgrove led the Cleveland Clinic, that was an organization that was filled with light. They went through a process beginning back in 2007, I think it was. In fact, the story begins, he visited a case study discussion at Harvard Business School. And while he was there, in the course of the discussion, one of the students raised her hand and said, "Dr. Cosgrove, what are you doing to teach your doctors empathy?" And he didn't have a good answer because he wasn't doing anything to teach his doctors. And that just caused, and actually, it turned out this young lady who asked the question, her dad had serious heart condition and had been choosing between Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic and decided to go to Mayo because he perceived that Cleveland Clinic was absent empathy. But this caused some reflection on the part of Dr. Cosgrove. And so he went back and said, what kind of organization do we want to be? And they decided we want to be one that shows empathy all across the organization, not just for our patients, but for each other as employees. And they did that. And you know, the results of what they did were actually remarkable. If you look at what happened to their patient satisfaction scores and their employee satisfaction scores and the growth that they experienced, and while also continuing to be technically excellent, right? Producing very high quality outcomes. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I read this part of the book, I was thinking of Campbell's Soup, which I guess now is just known as Campbell's, under Doug Conant when he was CEO. And I remember one of the tenets that Doug talked about was whenever you're unsure of what to do, nourish the relationship. Whether it's a relationship with your colleagues, with a supplier, with a customer, but it was a way of, again, bringing that positive energy and knowing they always wanted, that was where the emphasis was. And so it was a great guideline to sort of, you know, take out that flashlight and put some light in the room whenever you could.
Yeah.
Now, this is all very aspirational. As you noted, the dominant model is coercion and control, and I'm rooting for you here to help change things. And also, it can get derailed really easily, right? If you've got we put these self-interested executives at the top sometimes, who are not as concerned as people as we'd like them to be. We've got one of the best known CEOs on the planet wants people sleeping under desks rather than going home. So how can you bring this into practice if you don't have the most enlightened people at the top of your organization, or for example, in a large, say, government bureaucracy where a lot of things are rule-based and constrained and are designed to be more focused on the what we do rather than who we are as we do it. So how can you bring this in if you haven't got perfect champions at the top?
That's a great question. It's hard. It's really hard. But one of the things we hope happens as a result of the way that we articulate leadership and the principles and frameworks we provide in the book, we hope that it gives people confidence, regardless of their circumstances, that they can lead. And if they have a desire to lead and do something good, they can apply the principles in the book, regardless of the circumstances in which they find themselves. And sometimes those circumstances are really difficult to overcome. But a really important aspect of leadership is learning how to solve problems and pursue opportunities within any given context. And so we hope people gain some confidence and build a desire to do good and to lead regardless of the context. But I would say even within a power over environment, even within a tall hierarchy, people within that organization are given authority, right? And that means that there are people all throughout that organization who have some space, some degree, some sphere of potential influence. And I would say within that sphere of influence, they can apply the principles that we articulate in the book. They're not going to be able to, change the entire organization, or at least not do it all at once. But they can apply the principles in the book within their sphere of influence. And I really believe that this kind of approach is contagious. Once people get a taste of a leading through environment, I mean, really taste it, like what it's like to work for people who are trustworthy, what it's like to work with people who care about you, who really care about you. And what it's like to have the experience of taking initiative and proactively seeking to do good and to make things better and having success at it, using your talents and your abilities to make things better. I think that is really intoxicating for people. people really like that. They love it. They crave it. And I think that's contagious. And so I encourage people, even in contexts where the power over paradigm seems to be deeply ingrained, to work within their sphere of responsibility and opportunity to put these principles into practice.
So be a pocket of light.
Yeah,
So
exactly.
my final question is the same I ask all of my guests, and I think it's a very appropriate one to ask you given the tone and tenor of this book. What gives you hope?
Well, a lot of things actually, but I would, the one thing I would point to that comes to mind, and maybe in part because my life is so filled with the rising generation. The rising generation gives me hope. I have three sons. I've got a 9-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 22-year-old. And I've just been so impressed with how they've lived their lives. And I mean, they've grown up in a world that's so different than the one I grew up in. And they've faced challenges that I never faced. And they've overcome difficulties that I never had to overcome. And I've just been so impressed with my own son, but also with the students I work with at UTSA. I mean, there's a lot that's being said now about the rising generation. There are a lot of problems. I mean, our rising generation faces a lot of problems, but there's a lot of amazing things happening among the rising generation. I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. I had a student a few years ago who took my class. And most of my students, my undergraduate students, take my class in the last semester of their program. And so he took my class and he finished and he graduated and he called me and he wanted some advice about something. And in the course of that conversation, I just asked him, I was like, tell me about your experience at UTSA. And he really opened up and he told me about his life. I mean, this is a kid whose father was in prison, his mother was a drug addict. He actually spent 2 years of his high school years homeless and just bouncing around. And yet somehow he and his older brother was a year older than him. Somehow they figured out a way to go to college. And they figured out a way not only how to go to college, but how to do really well in college. And now his brother's a teacher and he works in finance and they're building lives together and they're starting to have families. And I mean, it's just incredible. You look at where they came from and where they are now, and it's just unbelievable. It's a miracle what happened to this young man and to his brother. And that's the kind of thing that gives me hope. I really, in my work with the rising generation, I see a lot of craving for leadership, and not just for others to lead them, but for them to have the opportunity to lead. I think they're hungry to be leaders, and that gives me hope.
Yeah, I think you're right. My time with my students, it always keeps me energized. And as I look at that generation, I think they very much are craving for the kind of leading through environment that you set forth in the book, that they're very frustrated with the command and control and coercion model and are not putting up with it. But I think it's part of where that generational friction comes from. Yet here we now have a very eloquent answer, or at least partial answer to that. In this new book. So my guest for this episode has been Jonathan Clark. He's the co-author of a terrific new book, Leading Through: Activating the Soul, Heart, and Mind of Leadership. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening and be ready to lead.